Radio.
Vital Faith Communities by Father Chris Ryan, MGL. This talk is from the Fifth Creator Colloquium entitled The Power of the Message, the Kerygma for the New Evangelization.
So as Kathy mentioned, the topic that I'm talking about today is called Vital Faith Communities, the Optimal Context for the Kerygma. And I wanted to start by actually telling you a little parable, a little story that I think might actually introduce our topic. So it's the story of a monastery that had fallen upon hard times. So the number of monks that had been there had at one stage been quite large, but as things had happened, and as often does in various times, the numbers had started to drop a little bit, and in fact then they'd started to drop quite considerably, until there were only a few left. And they were getting older, and there weren't too many signs of hope or renewal that they could look forward to. So in that context, the abbot of the monastery decided he needed to do something decisive and important, something critical that would maybe perhaps turn their fortunes around. And he heard of a rabbi, a Jewish rabbi, who lived perhaps the life of a sort of a hermit, as it were, in the forest beyond the monastery. And so he went to find the rabbi to ask him for his advice. It was one of those sort of last-ditch kind of attempts, I suspect. And so he goes to see the rabbi, and he asks the rabbi for a word, for some word of hope or encouragement, something that would be perhaps a plan, a way forward into a time of renewal for the monastery. And the rabbi simply said to the abbot, "The Messiah is among you. The Messiah is among you." So the abbot didn't quite know what that meant. He took it home with him, and the other monks gathered around him and said, "What did the rabbi say?" And the abbot said, "The rabbi said the Messiah is among us." And the monks kind of scratched their head. They weren't quite sure what that meant, and they began to talk about it a little bit. And one of them sort of thought to himself, "Perhaps the abbot's the Messiah." And then one of the other monks thought, "Perhaps brother so-and-so is the Messiah." And one of the other monks thought, "Perhaps another brother was the Messiah." And so they began to treat each other a little differently. I mean, if the Messiah is in your midst, there's a certain way you behave. And so what happened was that they began to treat each other with an incredible respect and care, because they might just have been talking to the Messiah. They began to really make sure that if they'd hurt somebody, that they sorted it out really quickly, because it could be the Messiah that they'd offended. They needed to make sure that they were living a life that reflected that the Messiah was in their midst. And as they began to live like that, word kind of got out. Their reputation started to grow. Here was a group of people that were really respectful of one another, and more than that, that really loved one another, that practiced the way of forgiveness, that cared for those who came into their midst. And all of a sudden, their monastery, which had fallen on hard times, became like a city on a hill, like a light, a city on a hill. People started to be drawn to the monastery. They wanted to come and be part of it. And all of a sudden, what had been a struggling community over time became a flourishing community once more. The Messiah is among you. Well, let's bracket the fact that their theology was a little questionable about where the Messiah resided. Isn't there a very profound truth in the story? That the Messiah is among them. And let's think about what happened there as they began to live with that awareness. There was something that changed in the way that they actually lived their lives. And that became the context for others to be drawn to the way of life that they were living and to the message. So let's kind of put that in the context of what we want to talk about this afternoon. Let's just say for a moment that the Messiah is among you might be a very basic form of the kerygma. It's not too far off it. And certainly, you know, the simplest, shortest version of the kerygma we have in the New Testament is Jesus is Lord. The Messiah is among you is not quite the same thing as that, but it's not that far off it. So a very basic form of the kerygma. Stick with the parable. Then we have, in the story, a very clear idea that the response to the kerygma, the response of faith, creates a certain kind of people who want to live a particular kind of way. They want to have a distinctive way of life. They'll be a particular kind of community marked by certain characteristics. That's kind of obvious, isn't it? That's the, in a sense, that seems to be the point of the story, that when people live as if the Messiah is among them, the kind of qualities of respect, that profound awareness of the dignity of each human person, of loving each individual, these are the sorts of things that emerge when a community is centered upon the kerygma. Okay. But I also want you to notice something else about the parable. And that is that the evangelization process in the story begins with the way of life that the monks begin to live. It's their renewed love for each other that actually attracts other people. The next step, presumably, was that those people who were attracted to the monks' way of life then heard the kerygma for themselves. They heard the word which explained why the monks were living the way that they did. Now, to put that in the language of evangelization, the ministry of the monks began with their own communal witness. Or even to go back a step further, it began with their own evangelization, their own conversion. The next step was their communal witness, which in turn meant that others came to believe in the proclamation, the message that they had. So I want you to hold that parable as we go forward and as we unpack the topic a little bit further. So yesterday and for this morning, we've been reflecting together about the kerygma, about proclamation. And that's a frequently neglected part of the ministry of the church in this day and age, sadly. It's frequently missed, as it were, for various reasons. What I want to say this morning presumes everything that we've been reflecting on about the kerygma, about the proclamation. And it will particularly presume the indispensability of that proclamation that is at the very centre of us coming to faith. It goes to the heart of what it is to be a Christian. We can't expect people to come to know the Lord unless they hear what that proclamation is. But what I want to do is to make sure that the concept or the nature of the kerygma is embedded in its proper context. It'd be a mistake to isolate the proclamation of the gospel from the appropriate context in which it belongs, which is the process of evangelization. So it needs to be held in relationship with a couple of other key terms from the language of the new evangelization or the lexicon of the new evangelization. And that is terms like witness and catechesis and initiation. Proclamation can't exist in a vacuum. It requires some other things to be brought together for real conversion and for the life of discipleship, and then also the continued commitment to evangelization to take place. So the question I really want to explore with you this afternoon is this. What is the optimal context for the kerygma? Where do we place the proclamation so that it will actually bear the fruit that God intends? So my suggestion this afternoon is that the optimal context for the kerygma is what I've decided to call a vital faith community. Now, I suspect that this might appear in this gathering obvious to most of you, if not all of you, for the following reason. You know that a person who responds to the kerygma, who says yes to Jesus, needs all the support and nourishment and encouragement and formation, catechesis, if their faith is going to grow. And that stands to reason. And what makes that possible, of course, is a faith community. Imagine, if we hark back for those of you who were here yesterday into Kathy's testimony, imagine if when Kathy had been on that first Antioch weekend and then for whatever reason she hadn't summoned up the courage to go and declare that she was going to turn up at the local Antioch group just down the road. Would Kathy be here today? Well, we don't want to sort of deny the possibility of the providence of God, but I want to suggest that it's much less likely. She needed a faith community to nurture and encourage the yes that she made as a young person yesterday or only a couple of years ago. So, to put this another way, if we think about the scriptural parable of the sower and the seed, we know that the seed of faith is the word. And we're told in the parable that what's required is good soil for that seed to grow and to take fruit. I want you to think for a moment about that seed that lands on rocky ground. That's the seed, in other words, that doesn't have a sufficient context for growth. It lacks the essential nutrients, as it were, that will allow it to grow and to flourish as it should. That's what good soil provides. Now, all that should be rather obvious, although it perhaps also immediately suggests a real-life problem. And that is that our parish communities often, not always, but often, aren't particularly ready or well-equipped to nurture somebody who has said yes to the kerygma. And I think that's something of our lived experience. They're not particularly well-equipped to nurture the infant faith of people who need to be supported in those initial steps. So part of what we want to talk about today is how do we allow such a community to flourish so that that support happens. But there's another reason why a vital faith community is the optimal context for the kerygma. And that is that a vital faith community is the best, not only, I'll grant you, but it's the best instrument to offer the witness to Christ that leads a person to be open to that proclamation in the first place. So perhaps to make my point a little more clearly, I want to tell you about two parish missions that I was a part of over recent years. One in one part of Australia and one in another part of Australia. I'm not going to tell you which either of them was. So in the first mission, there were a number of us who, from the Missionaries of God's Love, brothers and sisters, who went to this particular place, a small country town really, and we spent a weekend with the faith community. And the group that had really been the driving force about inviting us to come had been a little prayer group. And they'd invited us to come up. They got the permission of the parish priest. I knew the parish priest from my work with World Youth Day, so he grudgingly let me come. He's actually a good mate of mine. And we went up for the weekend, and they had really done the groundwork well, this little prayer group. So there were 80 people that came for the weekend, and we spent the weekend basically going through the kerygma with them, okay, explaining and proclaiming the gospel. And as a consequence of that, there were some really beautiful and significant stories of people coming to know the Lord in all sorts of beautiful ways. Several years later, down the track, that small group is still, it's a larger group, it's still flourishing. The sisters often go back to that faith community. There's a real sense in which what was sown there has continued to bear much fruit. But my point is not just that it continued to grow, but the very fact that they got the number of people that they got there and there was a willingness and openness to the proclamation is all about a vital faith community, even though it was a little small prayer group. The second parish mission, we were invited to come and to spend some time. In fact, it was a week that we came down for the mission. And with the best will in the world, the parish priest had been driving the mission. But I think he felt that if he just simply got up on a Sunday and said, come to the mission, that people would come. Now, in that context, there are some people who still say yes to Father when in that situation, and they will come. But it's a small group of people. And so they felt like they'd done the publicity, but there wasn't the same sense of a faith community. It wasn't the same sense of a small group of people who had done the personal invitation, who'd been praying together beforehand, who in another way had provided the witness, the context for that week together. And so we did much the same thing that we'd done in the weekend at the previous parish mission. But several years later, there are a couple of stories of encounters, of conversion, if you like. But that same sense of a parish that is being renewed through that experience hasn't taken place to the same degree. Now, we might argue about whether the proclamation had been dramatically different. It probably hadn't, I don't think. Maybe one was slightly slicker than the other. I'm pretty sure that's not the reason. The reason was about the faith community that was there beforehand. They were the seed, the soil for that proclamation. They provided the context for that proclamation to bear fruit. So some of the things that we're talking about there are a much greater receptivity. If you had contact with that small parish group and you knew that they were really excited about that weekend, and if you had perhaps had an experience of the people in that group and you'd said, they actually really like me, they take an interest in me, I trust them in some way, you're much more likely to get there in the first place. And that's why they got a much larger group, even though they were from a much smaller place. But they'd also been able to provide that witness, therefore, that might have, that would, that drew people there in the first place. So to repeat what I've been saying, a vital faith community is necessary to nurture someone's faith after they've responded to the kerygma, but it's also critically important prior to proclamation to create the optimal condition by which a person's ready to hear the gospel. A group of people, so at this point, let's try and define what I mean by a vital faith community. Here's my definition. It's a group of people who've heard the kerygma, they've responded to it with faith and conversion of life, and so they're seeking to live together the way of life that flows from their yes to the kerygma. It might be helpful here to introduce some other language from the New Evangelization to clarify what I mean. So in hearing the kerygma and responding with faith and conversion, these people have done more than say yes to a message. They've given more than a notional assent to an idea or a concept. Through the proclamation that they've heard and their response to it, they've encountered Jesus. Father Jared made this point this morning. They've met a person, the Lord of history, the Lord of life. And so the life that they are now seeking to live is a life together that flows from that encounter with him. And so I want to suggest to you that encounter is a seminal word for the new evangelization. And its importance for faith communities is that the way of life that we're called to live flows from that encounter. And so I want to emphasize here that it's a way of life. We need to recall here the Acts of the Apostles, that the earliest description of the Christian community was that they were followers of the way. They lived a distinctive way of life together. And so this way of life flows from a personal, decisive encounter with Jesus. And that way of life is more than simply a program for action or a set of religious practices. It's a life lived together that's animated and empowered by the Spirit of Jesus. And so a vital faith community is seeking to follow Jesus together by explicitly drawing upon the Spirit's power. This way of life is only possible to the degree in which they rely upon God's help and his support and his strength. Now, there's a possible objection to what I've said here in that we might say, well, that ought to apply to all faith communities. What's this distinction you're making between a vital faith community and everything that we call a faith community? Well, the answer to that is, indeed it should. Everything that I've just said ought to apply to every faith community. What I've described here should be normal. And indeed, it is normal in one sense. We use the word normal in two ways. First way that I want to use the word normal here is that it's a norm. That the norm of Christian life together, the norm of Christian community, is that it ought to be a people who have heard the kerygma, encountered the Lord Jesus, and are living the way of life together that flows from it. That's the first sense of norm. Now, what I've just said is not normal often enough in our parish communities. What's normal in our parish communities is something that's a little bit less than that. They're not necessarily filled with people who have heard the kerygma and responded to it in this way. So the chief reason for that, of course, I think is that we've actually failed to proclaim the kerygma in many ways. What I want to suggest to you here is that the church has a collective hangover from Christendom. So in other words, we're still getting over the fact that faith isn't simply handed down by osmosis, by a supportive culture. In Christendom, that's exactly what happened. If the culture and religious faith are combined, there's a natural sense in which faith is passed on because everything in the culture is supporting it. That's not where we are as a culture anymore. Archbishop Julian pointed to that fact yesterday when he pointed to the particularly a seminal moment in the 1960s, and I think that is the moment that we're talking about where a decisive break into a post-Christian culture took place. And so we have this hangover from the fact as a church because we still haven't actually accepted that fully. The new evangelization is the Bloody Mary to that collective hangover. It's the tonic that's needed. It's that what you have to actually wake up from the fact that you're having a hangover and to get better. That's what the new evangelization is. It's the realization that we are in a post-Christian culture and we need to do something differently as a consequence. What is different? It'll be the proclamation of the kerygma first and foremost, but it'll be vital faith communities that actually support and provide that context for the kerygma. So in other words, we can't presume faith. Not the faith that comes from an encounter with the Lord Jesus. It's not to deny the faith, the legitimate faith of people who are in our pews on Sunday, who faithfully turn up, who pay their dues, but who, if you ask them about whether they knew the Lord, they would give you a bewildered look. And I say that because I have been one of those people. Father Jared shared this morning that he was one of those people too. If you'd asked me at age 16 and a half if I believed in Jesus, I would have said yes. If you'd asked me if I believed in his resurrection, I would have said yes. I was trying to be a GCB, a good Christian boy, good Catholic boy. I was trying as best I could. But if you'd said to me, do you know Jesus Christ? I would have said no. Well, I would have been confused. I wouldn't have known how to answer the question. Because I would have thought that Jesus was a figure from human history 2,000 years ago, but not someone you could know. He is a figure from human history who lived 2,000 years ago. But the very thrust of the gospel and at the very heart of the new evangelization is that you can know him now. I couldn't have answered that. And to recognize that there are people in the pews who were like me, who are like me or like I was, is not to be judgmental or to be critical. It's to recognize that real and legitimate faith that they have is insufficient and requires something more. And so we have to be prepared, I think, to name that and to recognize that that might be something to do with the fact that what we call faith communities aren't necessarily vital faith communities that can pass on the kerygma and lead people to an encounter with Jesus. So that's a hard truth, perhaps, but I think it's well and truly time that we face up to it. Let's drink our medicine. Let's have that Bloody Mary and accept that that's actually the truth. It's not to say, and this is really important as well, it's not to say that our parishes are bereft of people who have encountered the Lord. Not at all. I've never been to a parish, and I've been to a lot of them, as you heard through my previous roles in the life of the church, where I looked around and thought, there's nobody here who knows the Lord Jesus. Our parishes are not bereft of people who have met the Lord. But I also think that's not the same thing as recognising, particularly that what it means to be in a faith community together. Not simply personally responding to the Lord in somewhat of a private kind of way, but really seeking to live a life of faith communally, to live out that way of life as people who know the Lord together. And that's what we want to actually really emphasize and draw out in the course of the rest of the talk. The other thing about those people is that they're frequently outnumbered by people like me as a 16 and a half year old. Good people who have faith of some level, but who haven't yet encountered the Lord, who can't say, I know Jesus Christ, okay? And the reality is that that's often the majority of people in our parish, in our pews on a Sunday. Now, again, I want to just sort of give you a little story to illustrate my point. One of the things that the Missionaries of God's Love do is spend some time doing street preaching. It's kind of one of those baptisms by fire when you first join. And so it's all gone soft these days. But when I joined, we used to do it twice a week. And I'd been a law student just up the road at the university, and we did it in the centre of Canberra. And so each time we went, I would see people that I knew. They would walk down, I'd see guys I'd been to school with, people I'd been in law school with just only a few weeks before. And so we basically sing some songs together around a large cross, and then we would sort of split up while someone preached, and we'd all try and engage in conversations with the people who were around. One day I found myself talking to a couple, and uh, the it became, as we began to engage, he wasn't particularly excited to be talking with me. She was a little bit more kind of interested and open. Turned out they were both Catholics, but she had converted to Catholicism when she married him. And so we began talking, and we'd done a little bit of training, like Father Gerard's evangelical Protestant friends. So the question I said was, what do you think Catholicism is all about? That was the question that I posed. And he said, well, it's about keeping the Ten Commandments. And with that, he grabbed his wife's hand and started to kind of pull her away, saying, we've got to go. Not before she had shaken her head. Now, there's every chance she was shaking her head at me, thinking, you idiot, I just want to get out of here. You're, you know, what a waste of space you are. And off she went. I don't think that's what she was doing. My suspicion is that she disagreed with her husband's answer. And it may well have been the fact that she'd been through an RCIA process and she'd come to realise that there's much, much more to being a Catholic than simply keeping the Ten Commandments. Now, we know that the moral teaching of the Church is really important, but it flows out of the encounter with Jesus. And just maybe she was pointing to that. So, these people presumably are in our pews. These people are, you know, this couple are reflective of what I've been talking about. So, we're not trying to be judgmental, we're not trying to be condemning, but we do want to realise that Christianity is fundamentally about an encounter with Christ. And if someone can't articulate that, there's a good chance they don't know it. If someone can't articulate it, there's a good chance they don't know it. They haven't met the Lord, and they don't know what it means to be his disciple. Our response to that is in no way to be condemning. It's to invite them into that encounter. Now, one of the effects of being outnumbered, of those people who do know the Lord, who've met the Lord and know him, one of the effects of being outnumbered is that their witness, the witness of a faith, vital faith community, can be dulled or blunted. Because the people who have not encountered Jesus, who haven't allowed him to be the centre of their lives, are unlikely to be living lives that radiate Christ's presence. You can't give what you haven't got. And so the witness of their life will be a witness to what is most important to them, which means it'll probably be more or less indistinguishable from the broader culture in which we live, that post-Christian culture that we've been talking about. That's why I think we need the term vital to add to faith community. Because we want to try and describe communities where a reasonable number, a quorum in fact, are living a way of life as committed disciples of Jesus. Now, according to Wikipedia, which these days is the source of all truth, a quorum is the minimum number of members of a deliberative assembly, so like a parliament, that's necessary to conduct the business of that group. So if we're going to apply quorum, analogously, I hasten to add, if we're going to apply quorum to our faith communities, then our communities need enough people in them who can conduct the necessary business of the church, which is being disciples and making others disciples. There's no way other way that it's going to work. So we need that kind of quorum. Now, a quorum isn't necessarily a majority, I want to suggest. It doesn't have to be 50 plus 1. It just has to be enough. And we'll come back to that in a moment. So, in fact, we actually don't want everybody who's in our pews on any given Sunday to be someone who could say, I know the Lord Jesus and I've encountered him. We don't want that because we want people to be coming into our pews and worshipping with us who are yet to meet the Lord. That's actually the point of evangelization. So it's quite fine for that to happen. We want that, but we also want to be leading them on a journey to that encounter. And I suspect that the new evangelization, the heart of new evangelization is exactly that. And the challenge is whether we're doing it. So I want to suggest that this present time, a quorum might be enough people, perhaps within the key elements of the parish leadership, or a small group within the parish. Think of that example I gave you of that small prayer group and what they were able to achieve. I want you to think about groups like the Altrea from Cursillo. It might be a prayer group. There can be small groups within the broader context of the parish who together are living a way of life that constitutes a vital faith community. So a quorum's reached when there's a culture of vital faith, a culture of discipleship. that is the most visible way of life within that community. So we might say then that a vital faith community is a community, is a community which has a culture that fosters proclamation, that fosters the kerygma. And therefore, the people within that community are providing a witness to the distinctive way of life that flows from being a disciple of Jesus. Let's try and tease that out just a little bit further. Why do we need such vital faith communities as the context for proclamation? Isn't the proclamation enough? Isn't there an intrinsic power in the kerygma that will make it all sufficient? Why then do we need that? Let's think back to our parable for a moment, to the rabbi's gift. The people who came to the monastery, and some of whom who joined the monastery, didn't come in the first instance because they'd come to believe the message. Imagine if they'd heard the message out in their homes or in the marketplace, "The Messiah is among you," is what those monks up on the hill are saying. They would have gone, "Oh, big deal, that's what those monks do." They came because they were drawn, attracted by the way of life that the monks were now living. And it was then that they heard the message as if for the first time. I am sure that I got to 16 and a half and I'd heard people tell me that God loved me. I'm sure that people, I'd been to Mass every Sunday up until that point. I'm sure that people had told me that Jesus had died for my sins and forgiven me. I'm sure that people had told me that it was possible to know God. I just don't remember any of it until I was 16 and a half. What I saw was a group of people living a Christian way of life and who said, when I found them different from what I'd expected and experienced up until that point, that it was Jesus who had called them to this particular way of life. It was because they knew him that they wanted to live in this kind of way. And then I heard that I was loved by God. Then I heard that I'd been saved by the death and resurrection of Jesus. Then I heard it. Now, I don't think that's just my experience. I think that is paradigmatic for what it is to be in the process of evangelization. I think it's actually a framework for the way evangelization happens. We've already heard the phrase from the magisterial documents of Paul VI that people believe in witnesses more than teachers, and if they believe in teachers, it's because they're witnesses. That's exactly the point that I'm making. So in other words, vital faith communities are the optimal context for the gospel because they provide the witness to the distinctive way of life that flows from the kerygma. The witness of people living out the gospel helps people to be ready for that proclamation, ready to hear it as if for the first time. It increases their openness, and it's as if they're able to hear it in a way that they've never heard it before. It's because they want to know why the people they've encountered are living the way that they do. And of course, then they're open to the answer that it's because of Christ and their encounter with him and the gift of his Spirit that empowers them to live that way of life. Such people become receptive to the proclamation because they've already seen the difference that that proclamation makes in people's lives. So implicit in what I've just been saying is that the way of life that we call Christianity is attractive, desirable even. It's been one of Pope Francis's great contributions, I think, to the new evangelization, that he's reminded us of the centrality of joy, that this is the distinguishing mark of a follower of Jesus. Now, it would be a great injustice to the other papal architects of the new evangelization, to John Paul II and to Benedict XVI and to John 23rd, I dare say, to say that they were unaware of or drew sufficient attention to joy. But it's undeniable that Pope Francis has captured the world's imagination by his particular embodiment of the joy of being a Christian. So the witness of faith communities will be attractive to the degree that this witness is marked by joy, the particular joy that comes from knowing Christ, that he's risen from the dead, and that through him we are loved, forgiven, set free, and held in the Trinitarian embrace beyond death into eternity. It also follows that our way of life, the way of life of vital faith communities, is distinctive. That is, it is different from the world around us. In other words, it's countercultural. All too often, this countercultural dimension can degenerate into a position of simply saying no to things in the culture that are inimical to the gospel, that are therefore also inimical to authentic humanity. And of course, the media loves to position us in that way, as naysayers, as voices of negativity and of denunciation. But in fact, for vital faith communities to be countercultural, what's required is a much greater yes to our culture rather than a no. Now, to be sure, we have to say no when we must say no to all that is anti-gospel and anti-human. But it's our yes to our contemporaries that must prove much, much louder, clearer, and more decisive. This is the yes of love. This is the yes of a radical love. It's a love for those who aren't loved. It's a love for those who are rejected. It's a love for those who are neglected and excluded. And the reason why we say no to some things is because we're saying a much bigger yes to something more foundational about what it is to be truly human. And I draw you back to Father Jared's talk to take that much further. To illustrate my point, in 361 AD, when the Roman Emperor Julian briefly tried to remove Christianity and restore paganism as the official religion of the Roman Empire, he had to order the pagan priests to establish the organized distribution of food, because the Christians that were in trying to re-establish paganism, he had to provide some kind of counter to the Christian practice of feeding the poor, of caring for those who were neglected. Now, in a sense, that's been happening ever since. You think about our foundations of healthcare and of education. They have their foundation in the gospel. They have their foundation in the practice of Christianity. And one of the things that we've seen in over the last several hundred years has been the removal of that from the Christian ambit into the broader and increasingly secular culture. But they've been impulses of the gospel. So the witness of faith communities, therefore, is the witness of Christ's radical ethic of love to the poorest and neglected, to enemies, to those who are opposed to what we believe and stand for. It's the radical ethic of love, of continual and persistent forgiveness and reconciliation. Wouldn't it be extraordinary? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we as a community were once more known for our yeses much more than our noes? That even then people would see that our noes are actually yeses to what it is to be truly human. That's precisely what's required. And that's not something that is only the responsibility of our leaders. We're not able to point to our bishops and say, you should be saying yes and telling us about the gospel much, much more than you appear in the media saying no to various things that are happening in our culture that are contrary to life and love. It's our responsibility to allow our yes to the Lord to be so great that people are drawn and unmistakably attracted to that. Now, the foregoing obviously raises the critical point of the profound counter-witness of individuals and indeed at times of entire communities of faith that have also happened throughout the church's history. And that's part of our story. It's a history that includes actions that have deeply compromised the proclamation of the gospel, from the Crusades to the Inquisition to the church's collusion in colonialism and exploitation of peoples to clerical child sexual abuse in our own day. Now, we should never attempt to defend the indefensible. These moments, and many others, are profound distortions of the gospel. And the only responses to this are the responses proper to all sins: repentance, penance, and the redressing of wrongs committed to whatever degree that's possible. This also includes the offer of healing, God's healing, to those who have been hurt by the church, by the actions of her members and especially her leaders. And again, that's an action that the whole church must undertake. It's not excluded to her leader, not confined to her leaders, although it's really important that they do that. It's also something that we also play a part in. And at the same time, these examples of counter-witness ought to also call us to a more devoted imitation of Jesus. If we want others to see beyond the evil, beyond the mistakes and failures of others, and indeed, the mistakes and failures to some extent, a very real extent, of ourselves, then we have to be challenged to more deeply embrace Jesus' ethic of radical loving, individually and as a vital community of faith. I also think that we need to see our own failures and others' failures to live out the implications of the gospel as not being beyond the providence of God. St. Augustine had a profound sense of the weeds among the wheat, battling as he did with groups such as the Donatists, who wanted a pure church, free from those who had succumbed to persecution and apostatized from the faith. The Donatists wouldn't let those who had done so, who had apostatized, repent and return to the church. But Augustine was far too aware of his own moral weakness and others in the church to agree with the Donatist position. He knew we all stand in great need of the mercy of God. Always. In fact, Augustine actually used to make this very, very clear to the catechumens who were preparing for baptism in his community in Hippo. Those people who were being evangelized were told by Augustine on numerous occasions, you are joining what he called the permixtum corporum, a mixed body. He didn't try to hide the fact that there were weeds among the wheat. He pointed this out to them partly because it was obvious, they could see that very clearly, but also he also suggests that in a mysterious way, the permixtum corporum, the mixed body, is necessary, so that we might be constantly reminded to look beyond the mixed witness of our faith communities and the church, to Jesus himself. It's Jesus who saves us, not the church. It's God who works in and through the church, not the church under her own steam. And so paradoxically, those very weakness and failures, Augustine said, actually point us to the one who truly has the power to free us. So vital faith communities, that is those communities animated by the kerygma, are the optimal context for the kerygma because they embody it, they incarnate it, they live it out. And in so doing, they provide the witness that points to the encounter with Christ, which is, of course, the heart of Christianity. Hopefully, that's so far so good. I want to push this point just a little bit further. The common perception I think we have is that believing leads to belonging. That's actually almost a truism, really, in our secular culture as well as the church. If you believe in the politics of a particular political party, then you join the party. In a certain sense, if you believe in the Collingwood Football Club, you become a member. I was waiting for the reaction. Here's the point. The idea is that if we come to belief in Christ, then we'll join the church. We come to belief in the teachings of the Catholic Church, we've joined the Catholic Church in particular. I don't think that's actually how it works. It doesn't take too much to realise that people in some informal but sociologically powerful sense belong before they believe. You're likely to become a formal member of this or that political party or this or that football club, even this or that church, if you are already in some way connected to others who belong. And the prominent sociologist of religion, Rodney Stark, suggests that this sense of belonging, which he calls attachment, is actually critical to the phenomenon of religion. He goes so far to say that people will come to believe what they are most closely... they will come to believe what the people that they are most closely attached to believe. Now, in Christendom, where the culture and the Christian faith were intertwined, that was clearly some form of Christian faith. But in a post-Christian culture like ours, declining participation rates tell us that people's sense of religious belonging is far more clearly belongs to secularism than it does to being a Christian, or indeed to any other religious faith. That's not an inexorable tide, though. What is required are intentional faith communities where people do feel that they belong. That is, they feel welcomed, they feel loved, cared for, before they believe. They're far more likely to come to faith because they'll be ready to hear the kerygma, ready to learn why these people are the way they are, because they want to be like them. So I want to emphasize here that the belonging we're talking about doesn't make them a Christian. Only the kerygma can make someone a Christian. It's proclamation and the encounter with Jesus. But they won't be in a position to hear it unless they have some level of attachment to people who are living a life that flows from the kerygma. So in a certain sense, in the contest of evangelization, and I want to suggest that it really is a contest between different evangelists, those of the secular culture in which we live and also our claim for the gospel, it's actually the most authentically human, the most attractive, the most beautiful offer of the human life that wins. And the truth of the matter is that that's actually the story that we live by. Our challenge is to proclaim that, and everything I'm suggesting here, more deeply to live that, so that people see the attractiveness of Christianity. Now, what I've just described sociologically, that we need to find ways of letting people belong before they believe, doesn't that mirror or reflect the action of God, the mission of God, who loved us, who lets us belong even before we come to faith? We reflect this in the church by baptizing babies, but it's actually true of all of us. God loved us even to death before we loved him, before we belonged to him properly. He belonged to us, in other words, before we belonged to him. St. Paul says that while we were still sinners, still enemies, Christ died for us. Our God is the Father of the story of the prodigal son, who loved the son, who let him belong again to the family, well before the son had ever said anything about being sorry. This is the mission of God, and we simply share in that mission. In other words, there's a particular kind of evangelical hospitality that reflects the hospitality of God. A hospitality that welcomes people and lets them belong with the bonds of love before they share our faith or convictions. Before they share what we believe or even our own moral positions. Now, we can't compel anybody to believe, and that's precisely the point. There's got to be a way of welcoming people where we walk the fine line here of making our own beliefs clear of what we do stand for. Evangelical hospitality in no way requires the compromise of what we believe or hold to be true. But at the same time, there can be no evangelization if there are no spaces for people to belong before they believe. And in fact, I want to suggest we're betraying the fundamental hospitality of God when we fail to offer those spaces. I'm not advocating indiscriminate baptism here to all comers, nor am I asking for admission to communion for anybody, for those who don't share our faith or our central beliefs. What those sorts of actions are is to mistake informal but real belonging with the formal commitment to faith, and to hold that the liturgical assembly is the only place where people can belong before they believe. That's not what we're saying. What we want to provide is a place where people feel loved, even if they are completely opposed to everything we stand for, because it's the only way that they will ever come to realize the truth of authentic humanity that we proclaim. So, in the couple of minutes I have remaining, what then are the characteristics of such a vital faith community? The scriptural foundation here is the description in the Acts of the Apostles, in Acts 2, 42 to 46, of the ideal Christian community. There's no accident in the Acts of the Apostles that this description of the community flows from, it's immediately preceded by, Peter's kerygmatic homily on the day of Pentecost. So you have the empowering of the faith community, that initial group of 12, and the others that were drawn around them, on the day of Pentecost by the Spirit. Peter preaches in that context a kerygmatic homily and calls them to repentance, to conversion, to belief in Jesus, to baptism. And we're told that that was the critical moment. The next description is of the faith community. What are the characteristics of the faith community? Firstly, the apostles' teaching. Secondly, that they gathered and in fellowship. They lived a life in common. They celebrated the breaking of the bread. They gathered for the prayers. There were signs and wonders in their midst. They sold their possessions and they gave their goods to the poor, and we're told they praised God daily. And here's the interesting thing. And day by day, the Lord added to their number those who were destined to be saved. Now, it's an ideal description, which means it was always messier than that. But the reason why we have ideal descriptions is because we need something to aspire to. So let's unpack those really, really quickly. The apostles' teaching. It's significant that this is the first one mentioned. What was the apostles' teaching? Well, fundamentally, it was actually the kerygma, first and foremost. It was the proclamation of Jesus risen from the dead. Have a look at Peter's homily in Acts chapter 2. It was also catechesis. It was the teaching of being formed in faith that flowed from the kerygma, but also built upon it. We might also add to that what we now understand to be the centrality of the scriptures for the life of faith. Because what those apostles were actually proclaiming becomes the seed of what we now know as the Gospels and those apostolic letters that we call the New Testament. Number two, we're told that there was a fellowship, a communion. The Greek word here is koinonia. It was a life lived together, a unity that comes from a common faith in Jesus. What we're talking about here is what I mentioned earlier about radical loving, the way of respect, kindness, love for enemies and reconciliation. Today we would also include the dimension of pastoral care under this rubric, the need to care for those with particular needs within our midst. The third one was the description of the breaking of the bread, which is Luke's term for the Eucharist. And so a vital faith community will have the Eucharist at the very centre of its life. It will be at the very heart of everything that it is. And it will be a vibrant, faith-filled experience. The fourth one is that they gathered for prayers. Something extra to the breaking of the bread. They gathered to pray together in other ways, both personally and communally. They praised God. This is about prayer, I think, but it's also about a response of life to the joy of the gospel, to the joy of knowing that Jesus is risen. We're told that they also experienced signs and wonders in their midst. These were dramatic signs of the inbreaking of God. This is a sign that we believe in a God who is intimately involved in our lives, who can do remarkable things to show his love and care for us. And the most obvious example of that are some dramatic kind of examples of healing. Less dramatic, but deeply significant in evangelization, are those coincidences that point to a loving and provident creator who can combine all sorts of circumstances to lead us to faith, to lead us to a profound encounter with him. They also gave their money to the poor so that no one would be in need. And under this heading, we might include all the acts of service, of charity, of love of the least and poorest, of our social teaching as a church. It should be clear by now, and this is my last point, that a vital faith community is much more than a community which simply possesses the formal structures of faith. It's possible to have a faith community that gathers for Sunday Mass, that has some aspects of prayer together, that's got a Vinnie Society and has somebody who visits someone when they're sick. And yet the heart of the community is not where it should be or not where it could be. And that's because the soul of the community is the kerygma, or more accurately, the soul of the community is actually the risen Jesus. And we're being intentional about the proclamation of the risen Lord. So there are two things to cultivate such faith communities that are required. One is that we be really intentional about our proclamation, really intentional about what we believe. We be really intentional about the way of life that flows from that. So the second thing is that we make sure that our people are engaged in the life of faith, that they know why we're here and what we're about as Christians, that they know the mission that we're called to, that they're exercising their gifts in the service of that mission. When people feel that level of engagement together, the kerygma stays at the very heart of who we are as a faith community. Vital faith communities are the optimal context for the kerygma. Think back again to the rabbi's gift. It's because they were able to recognize that the Messiah was among them that people were drawn and added to their number. Thank you.
That was Father Chris Ryan, MGL, with Vital Faith Communities. The Fifth Credo Colloquium was organised by Sydney's Catholic Renewal and Evangelisation Diocesan Office and held at the Catholic Centre in Lidcombe.
Credo.org.au